The state school superintendent in Georgia took up a challenge when she went on TV. She took part in a game show on Fox. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? Apparently she was, since she won $1 million. She pledged her winnings to three public schools. But keeping $1 million may not be as easy as winning it. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Susanna Capoluto explains why creditors say the money belongs to them.
Before Kathy Cox, there had never been $1 million winner on the show Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
You are the first person that ever gets to say this. There's the camera.
Hi, I'm Kathy Cox, Georgia State Superintendent, and I am smarter than a fifth grader.
When the show aired last year, Cox promised the money to three public schools for blind and deaf students, including the Atlanta Area School for the Deaf. In the school's gym, the basketball team is shooting hoops. The athletes communicate by waving their hands and grunting. The coach is a volunteer, and the school has no workout equipment. Athletic director Reginald Best says the team's uniforms are secondhand. He's deaf and speaks through an interpreter.
Most of the uniforms that we have, sort of hand-me-downs, don't fit the kids. They're kind of squeezed into some of the uniforms, and it's a little bit embarrassing for them when they go to play other teams.
The school planned to buy new uniforms with part of the winnings, but it is competing with dozens of creditors of Kathy Cox's husband, John. He's a home builder and filed for bankruptcy after his wife's TV appearance. Atlanta's slow housing market left him and his wife $3.5 million in debt. She'd co-signed many of the loans. Alex Steele is a lawyer for the bankruptcy trustee. He says regardless of what Kathy Cox said on the show, the contract she signed with Fox TV says the money is hers.
The terms of the agreement are that prize money won is income to the recipient, subject to taxation.
Teal says it's a simple contract law issue, and $1 million would be the Cox's only asset. But for some in the deaf community, it's a moral issue. About 24 hearing-impaired people marched recently in a quiet circle outside the bankruptcy trustee's office. They hoisted signs that said, $1 million belongs to the deaf children, and robbing from the blind, shame on you. Georgia state officials have vowed to fight for $1 million. Russ Willard is with the state attorney general's office.
The state of Georgia's position is that Superintendent Cox was invited to appear on this game show solely in her official capacity as school superintendent. And accordingly, the winnings belong to the Department of Education for the benefit of those three schools.
For her part, Superintendent Cox says she never considered the winnings to be her money. But she does remember signing documents before the show.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an attorney. And so, you know, I basically was just cooperating and thinking I was signing what, you know, everybody signs.
Fox TV plans to pay $1 million to the bankruptcy court, where a judge will decide whether Georgia or creditors will get the money. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
We've emphasized other kinds of listener interaction on this program, I'm asking you to send us your opinions, story ideas, and questions over Twitter, Facebook, and our Soapbox blog. We like to think of social media as a kind of water cooler, where we can talk to you and track stories and topic trends in real time. Someone who's thought a lot about the uses and implications of social media in government, politics, and problem-solving is Clay Shirky. He follows the social and economic effects of digital technology. He spoke this week at the Gov 2.0 Summit in Washington, D.C. That's a conference on using technology to open up government and collaborate with citizens. Clay Shirky joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for having me.
We certainly saw social media active in the presidential campaign last year. To say the least. What's happening at the municipal level now?
Well, municipalities are a really interesting example of these kinds of technologies in use because municipalities are smaller, they're socially more dense, neighborhoods have a neighborhood feel, and so we're seeing groups of citizens organize themselves in cities to accomplish all kinds of things. I was just, in fact, talking to someone from Tucson yesterday, mm-hmm. trying to recruit the citizens of Tucson to help document and then rank the pothole fixing. right? So it's a completely prosaic problem, and yet a big part of fixing potholes is really the information piece. Where are the serious potholes that should be fixed today? And instead of having either a hugely expensive apparatus to survey where the potholes are, or simply not knowing where they are and not fixing them for days, there's now a possibility of just harnessing what the citizens already know because they drive the roads every day and making that available to government.
So instead of having to get some kind of government pothole commission out on the streets and do a six-month survey and wait another 3 months to issue a report and have it go before the city council, you can just have people who see potholes put it on a social media site and the information's there.
Right. And interestingly, it's not just that the people are near the potholes, but also now that we all have these devices that can take pictures, give it a timestamp, say when the picture was taken, and also increasingly say where the picture was taken. And so you get a real-time map just as a side effect of the things the citizens already know.
Are local governments monitoring social media sites or even using them this way?
You know, it is like everything in the United States experiment. It is entirely variable by region. You know, Portland, Washington, D.C., of course, with Apps for Democracy making all of their data available. Many people in the Bloomberg administration are very actively trying to use this stuff. And then there is a whole coterie of cities that are watching.
Are private companies sometimes in the advance? And I asked my wife had a complaint about a poor service from an overnight delivery company that she put on Twitter. She got a call in a few hours.
Private companies, because the market motivation is often really sharp, they have been, the ones in the vanguard have been remarkably good about watching what people are saying about them and trying to learn from it. But also, private companies have been remarkably good about helping the users help each other. Famously, any electronic device you get has settings you don't know or can't understand. And so there's a simple thing you want to do and you can't do it. And you just say, why can't I make my digital video recorder do X? And someone else will come on and say, you can make it do X. Mm-hmm. Here's the three settings you change. And the company does two things. They save themselves a service call, but also they actually gain user loyalty because they're the host of the conversation that makes the electronics better even after it's gotten to the house. Hmm.
We, as you know, have tried to work the use of social media into our program. We do get some resentment from people who, some people, not everybody has access to the internet, or think that they have no interest in social media sites.
The conversation around the digital divide, this gap between who can participate and who can't, has shifted. In the 90s, it was mainly about access to hardware and network connections, right? Not everybody has a computer. But as computers have gotten cheaper and spread, as they've started showing up in civic places like libraries, and as phones increasingly have, even just through SMS, these kind of functions, the conversation has really shifted from the question of access to the hardware to the sense of permission and the sense of interest. And that's a much squishier, more social question. So part of the digital divide question, the new digital divide question, is how do we go to people who don't sense they have permission to speak in public and offer them that permission? And then the other, as you say, is the interest. If there are people who are just uninterested in this stuff, how can you make an experience that's still satisfying for them as, you know, traditional consumers of media without making them feel bad for not being the people posting the Flickr pictures of potholes or, you know, adding a comment to an NPR story?
Clay, I have a million followers on Twitter. What does that mean?
It means a million people are willing to hear what you have to say or offer or point to. I mean, it the meaning of something like that is really variable across a whole range of scales.
I mean, we'll point out that our radio audience is considerably larger than that, several times.
Right, of course. Yeah. No, right. But if you have a million followers, it really means you are a kind of a broadcast outlet. You can't follow a million people, both because you don't have the time to do it and because Twitter wouldn't let you. The system doesn't scale in that direction, only in the direction of followership. So it means at your scale, no matter what the medium allows, you've become a kind of micro-publisher on Twitter. Right. If I only have 5 followers on Twitter, we're probably a cluster of friends who are all following each other. So you get these different scales from the kind of conversational scale you might have at a dinner party all the way up to the Scott Simon audience of 1 million without any break in the technology. It used to be that one kind of technology was for two-way communication with your friends, right? You pick up the phone. Another kind of technology was for broadcast. You listen to the radio. Now you've got a phone that can turn into a radio without ever changing the underlying tools. And that mix and match of media patterns that were formerly completely distinct is one of the big changes in the current era.
But you know, Clay, and this is going to sound smarmy, but I really do think of each and every one of those million as friends. Now, there is something special about that.
There is absolutely something special to the relationship. All I mean is you can't have a two-way conversation with a million people. Yeah. The closest most of us get to this is our wedding day when you gather, you know, as many of the people you most love and would want to talk to in the world as you can get in one room. And then you suddenly realize, I got 3 hours. And so there is a constant width versus depth trade-off. Where you can either talk to a few people for a long time, you can talk to a lot of people for a short time, but you can't actually do what you want to do. What your million-person Twitter audience is that wedding problem every day you're on Twitter, which is you're at a scale where you can't sit down and talk to each one of a million people for 3 hours in a human lifetime.
Yeah, and I can't take a million people to Niagara Falls for a three-day honeymoon.
Exactly right. It's probably good.
Clay Shirky in New York, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And those of our listeners who, in fact, follow me on Twitter, you can watch my feed for a special message today. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams. The season of summer movie blockbusters is coming to a close, having raked in some $4 billion at the box office. Audiences were left Transformered, as well as Up-ed, Hangover-ed, Star Trek-ed, and Harry Potter-ed. Traditionally, cooler weather brings quieter films, and Oscar hopefuls Bob Mondello has a selected preview of Hollywood's fall movies.
Quiet time at the cinema will include 18th century poetry, dramas about relationships, and in the movie 2012, The End of the World as We Know It.
People have the right to fight for their lives.
The calendar of the ancient Mayans ends 3 years from now, and that's enough for the folks who blew up world capitals in Independence Day. In 2012, they'll be bringing plagues of meteors to the party, so be prepared to duck. Also surviving apocalypses will be Bruce Willis in Surrogates, Viggo Mortensen in The Road, and Elijah Wood in Tim Burton's animated film Nine. The rest of Hollywood will be hewing a little closer to real life, but there's still suspense to be had in, say, Mira Nair's biographical film, Amelia, based on the life of aviatrix Amelia Earhart.
I'm going to fly around the world.
It can't be done.
Well, let's change that.
If you miss this island, you're out of fuel with 2,000 miles to go.
I'll make it.
Hilary Swank looks so much like the real Amelia Earhart that the director was able to interweave actual newsreel footage in the film. Biopics not having that option include Coco Before Chanel, The Young Victoria, and Informant, in which Matt Damon plays corporate whistleblower Mark Whitaker, a guy so eager to be helpful to the FBI that it kind of gets in the way of his going undercover.
Would you be willing to wear a wire? We need your help.
7:30 a.m. I am approaching the entrance to the office.
Good morning, Liz Taylor, Secretary.
You don't really need to narrate the tapes for us when you're
absolutely
making them.
Just not a problem.
Once it starts, it is going to be intense.
Oh, what is he doing?
I told him the camera was in the lamp.
No. No.
If your taste in biography runs to something a bit more masterpiece theater-ish, there's also the story of a short-lived English poet. John Keats is pictured in Bright Star as a certifiably incurable romantic.
I had such a dream last night. I was floating above the trees, with my lips connected to those of a beautiful figure.
Whose lips? Were they my lips?
The makers of Bright Star hope their doomed poet was right, and that a thing of beauty is a joy for at least a few weeks at the multiplex. For longer-lasting romance, teenage girls have the latest in the Twilight saga, New Moon, about a high school student and the vampire she loves.
I love you.
You're my only reason to stay. Alive, if that's what I am. I promise never to put you through anything like this ever again. This is the last time you'll ever see me.
Uh-huh. Well, Not if New Moon makes as much money as Twilight did. Other teen romances include the film An Education, in which a 16-year-old schoolgirl is wooed by an older man, and Jennifer's Body, in which a high school student seduces and then eats her boyfriends. And if that's not your idea of romance, there's a documentary called A Love Story. Well, Capitalism, A Love Story.
This is Michael Moore. I am here to make a citizen's arrest of the board of directors of AIG.
We're here to get the money back for the American people. I got more bags. $10 billion probably won't fit in here.
Other documentaries include No Impact Man, about a New Yorker who takes his environmentalism really seriously, and This Is It, a Michael Jackson concert movie using rehearsal footage shot just before his death. And looking for a piece of that same music movie audience will be a remake, if you liked this. Hey, I'm gonna live forever. Producers are hoping you'll like this. A hip-hop-inflected version of Fame for the kids of the generation that saw the first one in high school. And for even younger kids, there's an origins story for a beloved children's novel explaining how a small town's weather forecasts began saying things like, cloudy with a chance of meatballs.
When my little town fell on hard times, all anyone could afford to eat were sardines. And because sardines are super gross.
Gross!
This was my chance to show everyone what I was made of. Conversion of water into food.
It really works! I love it!
Mamma mia.
Other kid flicks include Disney's first animated African-American princess in The Princess and the Frog, Fantastic Mr. Fox, voiced by the likes of George Clooney and Meryl Streep, and a live-action version of a beloved tale that Maurice Sendak told in gorgeous pictures and just 10 sentences about Max and the vivid imagination that takes him where the wild things are.
You are now the king, and you will be a truly great king.
King!
What's your first order of business?
It's the Wild Rumpus!
Fantasy is what Hollywood regularly serves up. Realism is rarer. The province mostly of low-budget independent films, the most heralded of the fall is the Sundance hit Precious, about an overweight teenager.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
Precious has her dreams, but very little else in life.
You're a dummy. Don't nobody want you. Don't nobody need you.
You're 16. You're still in junior high school. And you're pregnant with your second child.
Precious leads a parade of films with serious themes, and there's another parade of films with serious directors, including the Coen brothers with the quirky comedy A Serious Man, Pedro Almodovar with the film noir Broken Embraces, and Rob Marshall, the guy who made Chicago, this time directing a musical about a director who turns to the women in his life for inspiration, among them Nicole Kidman, Penelope Cruz, and perhaps because there's a song called Be Italian in the score, Sophia Loren. As Loren makes an entrance in the movie trailer, the music becomes a fanfare, and the singer and everyone else turns her way as if a goddess has arrived. And of course, one has. Forty-six years ago, Federico Fellini called this story 8½. Add music, and it becomes 9. And the way the studio is beating the Oscar drums, it had better get at least that many nominations. I'm Bob Mondello.
We have trailers of the new movies, as well as other movie coverage and reviews, at the Arts and Life section of NPR.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Matthew Morrison has the kind of talent that is most often seen on stage. An actor who can also sing and dance, he starred as Link in the Broadway production of Hairspray, won a Tony for his work in The Light in the Piazza, and sent shivers down the spine of Rodgers and Hammerstein fans with his spot-on portrayal of Lieutenant Cable in the recent revival of South Pacific.
Younger than springtime, are you
Softer than starlight are you, warmer than winds of June are the gentle lips you gave me.
Now, Morrison brings his considerable talents to the small screen in the exuberant and funny new Fox show, Glee. He plays Will Schuster, a high school Spanish teacher, who decides to lead his school's down-and-out Glee Club back to the former glory it enjoyed when he was a student. In this scene, Morrison struts his stuff for his students and shows just how wide a range he has with his version of a Kanye West hit.
Cutie the bum met her at a beauty salon with the baby Louis Vuitton under her underarm. She said, I can tell you rock, I can tell by your charm. Far as girls, you got a flock, I can tell by your charm and your arm. But I'm looking for the one, have you seen her?
No, we ain't seen her, she
giving my. Now I ain't seen, she a gold digger.
Matthew Morrison joins us from our studios at NPR West. Good to have you on the show, Matthew.
Very nice to be here, Lynn.
Now, I know that you have done some TV roles here and there, but as I said, you really are kind of a Broadway guy. So were you at all wary of taking on such a big part on a TV show?
No. You know, I have been, for the past five pilot seasons, I've always come out to L.A. and done a pilot. So this is the first one to actually go. And, you know, if I could have written a part for myself, this would have been it. It's a perfect transition from going from stage into TV.
What makes it so perfect for you?
Well, you know, obviously the singing and dancing make it really special and suited to what I do well.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
And, you know, I've kind of based this character on a couple of teachers that I've had in the past.
Who? Tell me about those teachers.
Well, one of them is this guy, Ralph Opasek, who was the director of the performing arts program that I went to in high school. The other, his name was, I call him Mr. Dorn, obviously, but his name is Phil Dorn. He was an English teacher I had in high school. And he was just so optimistic. One of those teachers that it was just, everything he said, it was just so infectious.
Let's talk a little bit about the high school in Glee, because it's very funny, and it really does work with the stereotypes we all have in our minds about high school. I mean, did it bring back any bad memories for you of high school? Or
no, I actually had such an amazing high school experience. I know, you know, there's no real middle ground when you talk about, when you ask people about their high school experiences. They either loved it or they hated it. I'm probably the only person in the show, the only actor on our show that really just enjoyed high school. I got the most out of it. I was involved in so many programs. But the character on our show that I kind of associate myself with is Finn, because I was really into athletics as well, and I kind of had to choose at one point between playing soccer, which was my sport, and being in the musicals.
And of course, Finn is the jock, the quarterback on the football team, who decides to get involved with this kind of pathetic group of very talented singers and dancers in the Glee Club.
And I can't fight this feeling anymore.
I suddenly realized why I had wanted to do this thing in the first place.
What I started fighting for.
It was seeing the gift in a kid that they didn't even know they had.
And I can't fight this feeling anymore.
It was pure talent.
If I have to crawl upon your floor, come crashing through your door, baby, I can't fight this feeling anymore.
Now, your nemesis in this show is the head of the cheerleaders, who is played really brilliantly by Jane Lynch. We're going to play a clip of a scene in which she gives you the lowdown on the high school pecking order. Let's listen to that.
Okay, so what you're doing right now is called blurring the lines. High school is a caste system. Kids fall into certain slots. Your jocks and your popular kids up in the penthouse. The invisibles and the kids playing live action druids and trolls out in the forest, bottom floor.
And where do the Glee kids lie?
Sub-basement.
You know, I wanted to ask you about this cast, because although the sort of premise here is that this is kind of a pathetic group of kids, these are amazingly talented people. What's it like working with the singers and that you work with on this show?
The best part of going to work is when we have, you know, when we're actually shooting a musical scene, you know, you can just see it in all the crew, all their faces, you know, because they've, you know, been doing shows for so long, but they've never done anything like this. So to go to work and to get to hear performances and stuff, it really just makes the whole vibe on set just so special and so unique and different than any other set I've ever been on.
And don't tell me you're sorry, 'cause you're not. Baby, when I know you're only sorry you got caught. But you put on quite a show.
There's sort of a revival of interest in musicals these days, whether it's on television or film or stage.
Absolutely. I mean, with, you know, all the musical movies that have come out, Hairspray and Nine is coming out, Chicago, it's a different world, and I think people are really a lot more accepting of the musical. And, you know, especially with the success of High School Musical, that was just huge. And, you know, people have called us the anti-High School Musical, which I think is kind of appropriate. Because our show deals a lot with the kids, but also you see a lot of the adult storylines.
How different is it performing on television, these big musical numbers? I mean, do you have to adjust your what you do in some way for the small screen?
Maybe a little bit. Because, you know, in the theater, you're playing to the last row in the audience. But all the songs in our show come from, like, we're either doing a performance or we're in a rehearsal. I don't just pop at us into song in the cafeteria, you know?
What are some of the songs that we're going to be hearing?
Like you heard, I'm going to be rapping a little bit. And it's going to be everything from, you know, bringing oldies back. And you're going to be hearing contemporary music. You're going to be hearing musical theater music. And I dare to say that some of the songs that we're doing, I think, are better than the original versions of them.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere.
Don't Stop Believing was the number one song on iTunes, and I really hope and I think that we might have a couple more number one hits.
A singer in a smoky room.
A smell of wine and cheap perfume.
For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on and on and on. Strangers waiting. Up and down the bus.
Well, I know, of course, every actor's dream is to be part of something that's really popular, but are you ready to make a long-term commitment to a TV show? What would that do to your stage career?
It's a little scary, I'm not going to lie. Somebody told me that more people saw the pilot of this show than the entire 10 years I've been performing on Broadway. So, but it's exciting in the way that I get to showcase what I do well to such a huge audience. And actually, my mom is actually in Argentina right now, and she saw a commercial for Glee. It's just it kind of blows my mind a little bit.
Matthew Morrison stars in Glee, a new musical comedy TV show which airs on Fox. He joined us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks for being with us, Matthew.
Thank you, Lynn.
Some will lose, some won't sing the blues, never mind.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Leanne Hansen is back next week. I'm Lynn Neary.